The scripture reading for this morning will be Luke chapter 23, verses 33 through 43. When they arrived at the place they called the skull, they crucified him there, along with the criminals, one on the right and one on the left. Then Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, because they know not what they do." And they divided his clothes and cast lots. The people stood watching, and even the leaders kept scoffing. "He saved others. Let him save himself, if this is God's Messiah, the chosen one." The soldiers also mocked him. They came offering him sour wine and said, "If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself." An inscription was above him, "This is the king of the Jews." Then one of the criminals hanging there began to yell insults at him, "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other answered, rebuking him, "Don't you even fear God, since you are undergoing the same punishment? We are punished justly, because we're getting back what we deserve for the things we did, but this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And he said to him, "I assure you, today you will be with me in paradise."
Good morning. As I mentioned last week, this week is on the old church calendars, on the called lectionary, the end of the calendar year where preachers start over. So in theory, I'm supposed to have reached the end of Luke. I don't know that we got there, but in theory, supposed to have reached the end of Luke, and then next year you start a new gospel. Not sure why the old churches had their new year in the middle of November, but they did. And the end of the year was always marked by an occasion. In some of the old calendars, it's called Christ the King Sunday, or sometimes it's called the Reign of Christ Sunday. But the rule was that you ended every calendar year preaching about Christ and his kingdom, and that he is the ruler over all. When you look at the text of the New Testament, there's no shortage, of course, of passages that remind us that Christ is the King and ruler over all. In fact, it is maybe the definitive claim of the New Testament that there is something about this Jesus of Nazareth, that he's not just an admirable man, that would be nice. He's not just a noble person. He's not a person merely who was a great moral teacher. History has had many of those. But that this person, Jesus of Nazareth, is rightly called King. And he is endued with authority to direct the lives of men, including mine. Which is the boldest statements of all the Christian statements, that as long as Jesus is bossing other people around, I could be pretty happy with it. But when I go a step further and say he is king even of my life and is the director of my choices, that is a pretty enormous claim. Because if there's one territory that every person claims to be sovereign, it's their own choices. Everybody still wants to be able to say, "I make my mind up, I do what I want." This little circle is called the region of Ben, and I do as I please, and everybody likes it that way. Christianity says, no, there's not one square inch, even of your own life, that does not belong to this Jesus of Nazareth. He is king. The anticipation of this kingship and what it meant is throughout the scriptures. Luke begins in the earliest part with the story of the birth of John the Baptist, and then later of Jesus himself. And this story is filled with anticipation of who Jesus would be. This memorable phrase from Luke 1, 76 through 79, comes from Zechariah, who is the father of John the Baptist. And he is proclaiming the glory of God to be worked through his son, that his son would be honored to be the one to go before the much more honorable person. How great is the kingship of Christ that it would be an honor just to be the one to announce he's coming. And so Zechariah gives this honor to his son and then says this about Jesus, "Whereby the sunrise shall visit us from on high to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace." Think about the expectation in that passage of what they were looking for. Now, at this time, not in some obscure and distant future, not someday, not, boy, I hope it gets here eventually. Now, at this time, this is what they expected to see. This was sunrise. All through their lives, they had lived in darkness. There were lights. God's light can never be fully banished from the world. But that light was like the light of evening, of night. When you're out at night, you can see a little bit. The stars are up and they're pretty and all. And the moon, even a supermoon, you know, moons are bright. That's fantastic. You can see a little bit. But it doesn't compare to what you know is coming. And what the man here is describing is his anticipation of sunrise. Finally, not little bits of God's light and glory, but the fullness of God's glory is coming into this world, and there's no place to hide from it. Listen to what he says. To give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death. This world is filled with death. But he says, even if you are all the way down at death's door itself, God's light will find that place. God's light is coming into the world like daybreak, and there is no place, even the valley of death itself, where you can be hidden from that light. Everything's going to be new. That's the anticipation of Jesus coming into the world. I think if you appreciate that a little more, then you understand a little better how completely distraught his followers were on the day of his crucifixion, when instead of light reaching down into the valley of death, they found their king in the valley of death itself. And as if, you know, to poke a little fun, we always wonder, you know, what exactly was pirates? That'd be a great Bible story. Jesus and the pirates, I'm sorry. What was Pilate's motivation for the sign he put above the cross? And the different accounts kind of put a little different spin on it. Sometimes it seems like he's being sarcastic. Certainly it's taken that way by the Jewish folk. They say, yeah, there's a king. The crowd, the guards, they don't think it's very interesting. There's at least one passage where they ask him to take it down. And Pilate seems to mean something by it. He says simply, what I have written, I have written. That's my story and I'm sticking to it. He just sticks it up there and says, that's it. But whatever it is that Pilate meant by it, we and the people there that day were struck by the bitter irony of the sign that hung upon the cross. Luke gives you the short version of it in Luke 23:38, King of the Jews. This is Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, written in three languages, so that nobody who was there would miss the joke. And what was the joke? Kings don't die on crosses. Murderers die on crosses. Rebels die on crosses. Insurrectionists die on crosses. Traitors die on crosses. Miserable, low-life scum dies on crosses. Kings don't die on crosses. The people who didn't become king die on crosses. The cross was the ultimate instrument of humiliation. It was how the power of Rome said, we have power and you don't. And here is the proof of that. Give us your most powerful figure, the man who would be king, and we'll put him on this cross. And it was a demonstration that he could not save others from the power of Rome. He could not assert authority over the figures of Rome. He could not even save himself from the power of Rome. He could not even save his dignity from Rome. Here is a man not just put to death. Here is a man humiliated in suffering and death. You see how startling those two images are? You come into the world and the angels herald your birth. Peace on earth, goodwill towards men. Zechariah says, light of God is coming into the world and the valley of death itself will be illuminated. And then you see his life unfold and here he is in the valley of death and it doesn't seem bright at all. As if to play into the joke, what happens next? The sun is covered up and there's darkness over the land. This is the valley of death. This is as far from that light as you can possibly imagine. So what we're challenged then with the book of Luke in this particular telling of the crucifixion is to ask ourselves if we are still able to see the king when the king is on the cross. I don't know if Pilate saw it or not. And Pilate saw something. Pilate's an interesting character. Half the time I think he's just toying with us. Sometimes I think he's serious. I don't know. I don't know if Pilate knew. I think he was very conflicted that day. But ultimately, the question we're asked by the gospel is whether or not we can see the king on the cross. Because the people that were there could not. Not the Jewish people, not the soldiers, not his own disciples who fled. When they looked at that scene, they could not see any king. And here's the proof of it, because they talk about it. In Luke 23, and this is our text, by the way, in Luke 23 is where we're going to stay. In Luke 23, verses 35 through 37, they issue this challenge, spoken in two different ways, but it's the same challenge. And the people say it first. The people stood by watching, but the ruler scoffed at him. So you have the people, and they're staring and trying to figure out what to do. And then the rulers from among the people, who are the rulers? I don't think this is Pilate. I think this is the religious rulers. This is our chief priests and Pharisees and scribes, the same people who taunt Jesus in so many scenes and pick at him. Now they have had their say. They've carried the day, they think. And so now they ask their question. The rulers scoffed at him, saying, "He saved others. Let him save himself, if he is the Christ of God, his chosen one." And then, to make sure you got it, the soldiers in the next verse also mocked him. So we have the Jewish folk on one side and their leaders. We have the Roman garrison on the other side. And they mock him, coming up and offering him sour wine and saying, "If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself." But two different points of view on the same question. The religious leaders are asking it from the Jewish point of view. Are you the anointed one? Are you the chosen one? Because you know what the chosen one ought to do? He ought to save himself first. Show us the power. The Roman soldiers don't know anything about this Jewish stuff, but they know what a king looks like. If you're king of the Jews, save yourself. What's implicit in this? What you're doing right now is the least kingly thing you could possibly do. You're supposed to be the one who's going to come and save us from the Romans, challenge the authority of the emperor, invoke God's peace on the world. You can't overcome the nails. You couldn't overcome a petty puppet like Pilate, let alone the emperor himself. So this is a challenge. Notice the "if" in both verses, right? If. It's mockery. This is an interesting side note, just a tidbit. When you're reading Luke's account of the crucifixion, Luke, though he is a physician, has no interest in what happens to the body of Christ. He does not describe the nail-pierced hands very much. He doesn't talk about the excruciating agony. As a doctor, I would expect Luke to tell me about the suffering of crucifixion. Luke has nothing to say about that. When Luke describes the crucifixion, if you read it, where Luke wants to spend his time is when people mock Jesus. To him, that was the crime. The pain was almost incidental. To him, the crime was that a human being could stand at the foot of the cross and mock Jesus of Nazareth. The suffering was a side note. Through the trials, he does the same thing. They hit Jesus, they strike Jesus. Luke mentions that. But where he spends his time is where it says, "Then they mocked him." They challenged him with questions like these. "If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself." So what Luke does for us then is paint this picture. I want you to walk through it carefully with me. At his birth, we have the anticipation of who he should be. At his death, we are distraught to see the exact opposite of all that we hoped. But what Luke does very carefully in this 10-verse section from 33 to 43, right in the heart of it, he has the accusation, the challenge. If you're the king, do something kingly. And then Luke, in telling the story, puts two of Christ's most kingly acts right in that moment on either side of the challenge and lets you notice he hopes the kingship of Christ even on his cross. Let me back up a few verses and show you the first one. I want to suggest to you this is a profoundly kingly royal act. This is Luke 23 and verse 34. And Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And they cast lots to divide his garments. So again, the mockery continues. And I think that's what's going on in the dividing of the garments in Luke's view of things. The dividing of the garments is, again, a greater shame cast upon Jesus. But they're treating him already like a corpse. What do you do when someone dies? When someone dies, if no one wants their stuff, I guess we get to divide it up and see. And if you're a particularly callous person, maybe in their last few breaths, you can go ahead and start talking about who gets what. Want to get my dad angry? This is fun. We do this every Thanksgiving. It's kind of a tradition. We sit around in Dad's library and we start looking, and Clint and I start saying, "Well, I think I'm going to take those. Well, I want these. You can have those." And Dad's sitting there in his chair, "Hey, I'm still alive. You know, you're not supposed to divide up the books quite yet." And we think it's funny. He's not so much entertained. It's a particularly calloused person who starts dividing up someone's stuff before they're dead. And here is the man breathing in agony his last, and the people down below are dividing up his stuff. That's callous. That's grim. That's mockery of a terrible sort. But what is Jesus doing while they do that? Jesus is not participating in that. Jesus is not even weighed down by that. Jesus is at his most regal. "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." What is that? You ever pondered? What is that? Who says that? That is a strange thing to say, unless you're a king. Here in a few months, not very long actually, not even that few weeks, President Barack Obama, after 8 years, will be leaving the White House and making his last official executive actions. What will be, most likely, his very last actions as President of the United States? Every president does it. On the way out the door, they issue pardons. On the way out the door, constitutional scholars call it the benign prerogative. It's the right of the president at the very, well, he could do it anywhere through his presidency, but they're always so controversial, nobody dares. When you're at the very end and no one can throw you out any further than you've already been thrown out, it's all over, right? Whether 4 years or eight, your bags are packed, and that's when they sign the pardons. Some of them do it for flunkies and different people that they want to get out of jail. Some of them do it for cases they think are particularly unjust and they want to do something right on their way out. Some of them do it just out of mercy. But essentially all presidents do it. On the way out the door, the last thing they do is to issue a pardon. Why can't I issue pardons? You know, you and I are citizens of the same country he's in. Why can't we issue pardons? That's an executive function. Not everybody gets to walk around saying, "You're forgiven, and you're forgiven. You can get out of jail. You have no penalty for your crime." That's not a right that you and I have. The executive does. In days of old, the king did. That's why they go to Pilate. You remember what happened at the crucifixion and the trial? Pilate, was his custom, it said, at the time of the Passover, to release one of the prisoners to the Jews. Was it because he was innocent? No. Pilate, as an act of power and mercy, but mercy was secondary, as a way to remind the people who was in charge, the ruler released a prisoner once a year. He tried to release Jesus. They weren't interested. They get Barabbas. And that's how the story goes. But my point is, that's something the powerful person does. Now here is Jesus, stripped of all hint of power. He doesn't have power. He doesn't have a force behind him. He has nothing on him that makes him look kingly, despite the inscription above his head. He's been stripped of his clothes. They're bickering over that down below. But what is Jesus doing on the cross? He is doing what only a king can do. He is saying that by his right, he is willing to pardon even these, the greatest of criminals. And the greater the crime, the greater power you have to have, right? If you forgive somebody's parking tickets, that's impressive, I guess. You forgive a murderer or a thief? Or like Pilate let go Barabbas. Barabbas was bad news. That demonstrated that Pilate had serious power, that he could afford to let a man like Barabbas out of jail. Who does Jesus forgive? His murderers. He offers forgiveness to the lynch mob that is killing him at that very moment. What kind of power is he claiming? Folks, there is no question he is either a lunatic or he is the Lord. Because he is claiming the power as a crucified man to look at the people who are trying to show him their power. I have the right to forgive you even of this most heinous crime. That's a scene where you see Jesus upon his cross, still acting like a king. Skip down a few verses, he does something just like it. He's at his most kingly at the cross, unfazed by the shame you think he should have. In verses 39 through 43, you get this discussion that's well known between one of the thieves that was on one side and Jesus himself. Now, the thieves have had their say. They've made a little fun of him. And one of the thieves has kept on going. He's really poking at Jesus. And the other thief decides that's inappropriate. He makes some interesting comments. Man, if you want somebody I have questions for. I told you I got questions about Pilate. I got questions for the thief. I'm curious what is going through his mind this day. When he turns to his friend and he tries to explain himself, he says, "You and I are being crucified because we deserve it. We've committed crimes and they're putting us to death, and that's fair. This man is innocent. He doesn't deserve it." Now, up to this point, everything makes sense to me. Everything makes sense to me. One man on death row looking to another man on death row and saying, "You don't deserve to be here." I can kind of understand that. That makes sense. But that's not where the conversation stops. Instead, he says this, and he says, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." We get to add somebody else to the lunatic category. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. Kingdom, he's not coming down off this cross alive. This is the opposite of kingdom. He's going to die today, and so are you. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. I have to tell you, if it wasn't for what Jesus said next, I would assume he was being sarcastic and rude, wouldn't you? You say to a dying man, "Remember me when you set that kingdom up. Want a good seat?" I don't think you're serious. I assume you're being sarcastic. Jesus doesn't think that at all. Jesus takes it very seriously. I don't know what prompted the man to say these words. What convinced him that a dying man was king? Maybe it's because Jesus is just so unmistakably kingly, even in this moment. Maybe he sees what Luke is begging us to see. The king upon the cross. "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus proves again that he's either a lunatic or he's the Lord. Because he says, "Yeah, I will. Not just that, today you'll be with me in paradise." Who has the right to do that? Let's think back now. Just think about your law a minute. I want you to go down to a foreign country's borders, find people gathered at the border trying to come into that country. I want you to point your finger at them and say, "You right there, you're all citizens now of this country." Anybody think they have that right? Doesn't work that way. In our country, we're having, you know, this huge debate we've had now for years about immigration and how it should work and how it shouldn't work. One thing we're pretty sure of is that none of us have the right to walk around saying, "You're a citizen, and you're a citizen, and you're a citizen." It would be as foolish as walking around saying, "You're pardoned, you're pardoned, you're pardoned." Who can do that? Who can extend citizenship? And not even to a good person, right? Again, in our debates about immigration, we often hear that discussion. Well, there are some people that come in and they're good folks and we should let them in. And there are some people that are criminals and we should treat them differently. Which one is Jesus admitting into the kingdom? A person who is at the very moment being executed for his crime. Jesus says, "Yes, today in paradise." Who has that kind of power? Do you see the scene that we're being shown here? The scene that the world is seeing is a man being put to open shame, humiliation, The misery is almost a side note for Luke. This is an embarrassment. And yet the man himself seems utterly unaware of it. The man himself doesn't seem to doubt, even for a moment, that he is the most powerful man on that hilltop. It's not the angry mob. It's not the soldiers. It's not the man pronouncing his doom. It's not the people saying, "If you're king, save yourself." He shows them he can do something much more kingly. And he does it. He issues pardons. He grants citizenship. He treats his kingdom like it is a very real institution, even in his death, when nothing could be further from anybody's minds. What are the two quick lessons we can learn from Jesus and his cross and his kingship? Two quick points, and the lesson will be yours. Number one, the true test of a king is not in saving himself, but in saving others. The question they asked was, "Show us your power by coming down off the cross." Remember, the rulers said it, the crowds, they said, "If you're the chosen one of God, save yourself." The soldiers said it, "If you're the king of the Jews, save yourself." What did they think? The most powerful thing a person could do was to save themselves. Jesus says, "I can do something far more powerful." Jesus does something that demonstrates far greater power. He allows himself, in fact, to die. And in so doing, brings about the salvation of others. A powerful man can be generous. A powerful man can be merciful. A powerful man can say, "My life in this instant isn't the most important thing to be concerned with." That's kingship. That's a power we've never seen. Do our rulers act like that? Any of them? Look at our rulers. If they want to show us power, our heroes, our role models, they show us their power or their wealth or their prestige by showing us how great they can behave and do things for themselves. Self-centeredness is the center of our power. Jesus says, "Let me show you power." It's a power that has enough left over to save the whole world when he's done. That's power. And brethren, we've got to learn to look for that kind of power and see it in Jesus Christ. Second point, and this is huge. If you can look at the cross and see the king, then you know the gospel of Jesus Christ. This is the infallible test of whether or not you understand the gospel. When you look at the cross, what do you see? The Jewish leaders saw a man humiliated. The Roman soldiers saw a weakling who couldn't save himself. The disciple of Jesus Christ, in faith, looks at that cross and sees not a humiliated man, but the Lord of the universe in his infinite power, giving up even himself for others, issuing pardon, citizenship, and mercy. The question you have to answer then is, what do you see in that Lord? What do you see on that cross? If you see that person, then you have to behave differently. Don't you think? If the Roman soldiers had understood that this was the king, would they have behaved the same way? If the crowds had understood this is the king, would they have behaved the same way? One person figured out that this is the king, and suddenly he acted differently. He says, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." To know that this is the king means to act differently. And that's what you need to do today. To respond to his kingship and start treating him like a king. That was the difference. The man on the cross, the thief looked at him and didn't see another criminal. He saw a king. And he asked him for something only a king could give. And that's what Jesus demands of us. I suspect Jesus, and I may be speculating a bit here, I suspect Jesus is very, very tired of being treated like a good fella or a wise teacher. He doesn't want that from us. He wants to be treated as Lord. He doesn't want you to nod in his direction and say, "Yeah, he has some good mottos and advice. That Sermon on the Mount stuff is pretty good." He wants your unmitigated submission to his will. And he deserves it. If you've not submitted yourself to Christ Jesus, today we're going to stand and sing a word of invitation. If you see the king upon his cross, then respond to him in full submission in his kingdom. As we stand and sing, won't you come at this time?